Hey there, you're with Disembodied Podcast. This is Evie Escher. This week, my guest is Madhu Puradasa. He's a local to Orange County and a Laguna Beach denizen. He's a holistic health and business lifestyle coach who has trained hundreds of health and wellness professionals, coaches, and influencers in ancient sciences, thereby helping them create profitable online businesses. Madhu lived and trained for half a decade as a monk in the bhakti yoga tradition, which is something we're going to talk about. We should say there's a little background here. Madhu was born into a family of yogis. At the age of 16, his father offered to pay him $100 to read the Bhagavad Gita. What teenager doesn't like money? He accepted the offer, but the book completely changed his life and perspective. And it touched him so deeply that he refused to actually accept the $100 in the end. So he had a burning desire to dedicate his life to living and sharing spiritual wisdom thereafter. He became a monk on his 18th birthday, and for 5 years he lived in various monasteries across the U.S. and India, studying under world-renowned teachers and traveling the world whenever he could. And we should say that Madhu's quite talented in his free time. He's also a professional musician who tours internationally. It's funny, when I first met Madhu, I really didn't even know that he was living so close to where I live. But we're going to talk a little bit about ISKCON, that's Krishna consciousness, and all of Madhu's experience in monasteries and basically just kind of getting a handle on Vedic philosophy, ancient teachings, also how he helps people nowadays. So sit tight. Here we go.
Madhu, welcome to Disembodied Podcast. It's great to have you.
Grateful to be here with you on such a podcast that's really allowing so many to access spirituality in a practical way.
Yeah, thank you. I'm dying to get into your experience because you look quite young, but you've had a good 10 years under your belt of doing some pretty interesting things, like being a monk. I find that interesting, and that you lived in India and at different monasteries around the world, apparently. So let's talk about that a little, because you must have been kind of devoutly religious at one point to do that, I would think.
You know, it's a typical thought I get. But interestingly enough, what inclined me to become a monk is typically when we think of monk in the West, we think of, oh, they become a Buddhist monk or become a Franciscan monk or something like that. But after studying philosophy and theology for years, as a teenager, I was that weird kid that was like, what are those books you're reading? And after studying all these different, really into philosophy and also exploring different types of theologies around the world, kind of the Western Abrahamic practices, the Eastern practices that were there. The reason that I was so inclined to become a monk in the bhakti yoga lineage was because it's a non-sectarian practice. And so no matter what external label you might identify yourself with, you can still practice this. It's yoga practice that transcends more than just the physical stretching of yoga, which is helpful. I'm a big fan, but the actual philosophy of yoga, which goes back to India, which predates even Hinduism, even like Hindu practices, which is a very general, vague understanding of a religious practice, comes from the Vedic literatures or these ancient yoga literatures. So do many other theological practices, but they come after those actually texts were created. And so these practices that I explored as a monk were very non-sectarian, so that no matter who you are, it doesn't matter what ethnicity you are, what language you speak, where you come from, how much money you do or don't have, all these external designations were very much secondary. And then we come together on the level of the self or the soul or the spirit, where we're actually equal, we're actually connected with one another, as opposed to the bodies, which are all different, connecting on that level. So I would actually consider myself to be very discerning and potentially standoffish to a lot of traditional religious practices that might be there, which is somewhat counterintuitive.
Okay, so that's interesting. That's an interesting take on it. And you didn't feel that you became a monk to like commune with God or to, you know, figure out what God was. What do you think God is now?
Yeah, well, that's definitely the motivation there. the motivation there in a literal religious sense of like actually trying to understand the nature of divinity. That was definitely the primary motivator, even though it was detached from any particular sectarian designation that was there. Which in answering your question, the reason I was always inclined towards this age-old Indic and Vedic philosophy that was there is that they pose the questions of divinity in terms of three aspects. So there's a personal form of divinity, which the easiest way I always like to explain that is we can very much see there's powers higher than us in this world. And I always like to say, if you don't believe in a higher power, just go stand out in the sun long enough. It ain't going to take a long time to realize, okay, there are powers higher than myself that have a little more sway on my mind and my physiology than I do. Or go into the middle of the ocean, you'll be like, okay, there's powers higher than me. So when we're talking about this traditional perspective of divinity, one aspect of it is that the highest of the high powers, if you will, that original source. There's also a manifestation, what's called the super soul in Sanskrit, the Paramatma. It's divinity within our bodies. So we are an individual soul self, that when I talk about me, I'm talking about the real me, not the biomechanical robot, AKA human body that we're driving around in. If I lose an arm, am I less of a person? No, because I'm not the body. I have a body. If certain aspects of my mind go off, am I less of a person? No, because I have a mind. I'm not a mind. You know, I'm something divine. I'm that soul. And so situated in the bodies, in our bodies, is our soul as well as the divine soul that's there with us. So one is there's that highest of all highs. Another manifestation of divinity is one situated with the heart of all living entities. And then the third manifestation is what's called Brahman or pervasive consciousness. The idea that divinity is manifest in every atom of this earth. And it's very much almost ambiguous. It's almost inaccessible and imperceivable because we're humans. Therefore, we understand things and relationships, or we could say aspects of relationships in the form of people, in the form of figures and forms. And so the idea of communing with all pervasive divinity can be very abstract, but that is a feature. And so there's typically, and then it's broken down as these primary features, these three.
It is kind of abstract in a way, but it does make sense. And I like that you mentioned, you know, going out and standing in the sun, because you know, really everything grows, even humans grow toward the light. They're drawn to the light. Art, a lot of times, is about capturing the light, whether it's photography or painting or whatever. And I think that light is, it seems to make everything function. So maybe God is light in some respects, that mechanism for illuminating the universe. Maybe that is what God is. I don't know. But I kind of wonder if you felt a little bit robbed of a teenage or young adult lifestyle, you know, going into monasteries at the age of 18 and doing that for like 5 years, I think you said. Did you feel robbed of like having a physical reality like so many other young people have?
You mean most 18-year-olds on their 18th birthday don't become a celibate monk and move to India?
Not usually.
Yeah,
right?
So it's interesting because I'm unique in the way, well, I'm very unusual in many ways, but one way that I'm maybe a little unusual is as a young man, as a kid, I always hung out with older friends for whatever reason. So my friends were always 3-4 years older. And so as a teenager, what I was doing at 15, what most maybe 18-year-olds were doing, whatever the case, and I mean, dare I go into the details, but you know, we're going to parties, anything you imagine a good old high schooler going into college might do, or, you know, those in college. And so from a young age, I got into practices that I very much am not into anymore as somebody who's been years as a monk. And, you know, everything from various types of intoxications and drugs to experimenting with women to gambling to kind of all the things that young adults get into when they have the opportunity. I did at a very young age. I'm even starting at like 10.
Wow.
Intoxication, stuff like that. My poor mom and dad. I love you guys, whether they know that or not. But yeah. And so by the age of 15, I was kind of over it. Everyone's going to laugh, but that's okay. At the age of 15, we got caught smoking with my friends by one of my friend's parents. And they called my dad. My dad came and kind of put a show to, how dare you? You know, he was very cool. So, you know, he chastised me, but then we got in the car. He's like, come on, man. Why don't you just tell me you're doing this stuff? And I said, you know, Dad, I don't want to be doing this anyway. I do it because I got to be cool. And I say, could I lie and tell my friends that you drug test me now so I don't have to like do drugs anymore? He's just like, yeah, buddy, like whatever you got to do. So at the age of 15, I actually started to, yeah, sorry, I can't party with you today. My parents drug test because I was so not into changing my control of my senses and consciousness that, you know, drugs would modify your perception of reality so much. And so I had those similar experiences. I just did them a little younger, probably stunted my maturing in some ways. So by the time I was 17, I was so over it. That's what actually propelled me into my study of philosophy. It was like, this can't be it. Like just chasing these material things, this cannot be it. I'm getting so little satisfaction from this, chasing, you know, a will-o-wisp, something that's certain to go away. And that's what actually drove my desire to finding something beyond that which has a beginning and an end.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's a good realization to have at a young age, that alcohol and drugs and random sexual encounters don't really lead to any type of satisfaction. I think if anything, it just leaves you kind of sad and empty a lot of times. And maybe that's a stereotype. I'm sure somebody gets some satisfaction in that type of stuff. But I remember being really fascinated with drugs, especially hallucinogens when I was younger. But I was frankly too chicken shit to really go to the LSD usage and, you know, really experiment. I found myself being a little too expansive and tuning into other people's thoughts and feelings already. And I thought, if I get into LSD or whatever, I'm just going to have like a bad trip. I'm bound to tune into some bad stuff and it's going to bring me down. So I never did it. But I know people that did. And sometimes they would say things like, oh, you know, LSD, it basically makes life so beautiful that you can't handle not being on LSD, really. Yeah. I've heard that, but I find that almost hard to believe. You know, what do you think of that? Did you ever try hallucinogens?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, very few times, because the idea of, yeah, leaving my typical control of my senses and my typical conscious state was just, and not being in full control. Well, who's ever in full control of their senses, but being in less control than I'm used to of my senses was always a very uncomfortable for me, because I knew that I was leaving reality, or at least the typical reality, and I was using something artificial, something outside of myself to go to a, well, artificial place. And one might argue to say that, oh, you know, who knows what real reality is, and, you know, maybe that brings you to reality. But what we do know objectively is that without taking things like that, which change our mental state, we are fixed in a particular perception of reality. So what I found dissatisfying about using intoxication was that you become dependent, as you so eloquently were expressing, you become dependent on something outside of yourself to go to a place. And, you know, it's so good. I've heard that before. But wow, it's so good when I'm on LSD or whatever it is, that it's sad to come back to quote unquote real life. What turned me towards meditation was, how can I achieve higher elevated states of consciousness, almost psychedelic-esque experiences, without having to rely on an external source? How can I find that within? Because if my mind can go to those places, and then I just need something that facilitates that, that means I have the capability of doing that on my own as well. It's just a matter of learning how to do it without something outside of myself or artificial. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think meditation can really take you to some interesting places. Have you ever done astral travel? Do you feel like you've utilized that ability to kind of get out of your body somewhat?
You know, it's interesting, because I myself have not had, you could say, lucid experiences with leaving my body and you know, going into, you say, according to the Sanskrit paradigm, they say that astral body, or it's called the subtle body, where your mind and intellect and ego actually separate temporarily from the physical earth, water, air, fire, air, and ether elements that the body's composed of, and it steps outside of that. I've never had any very obvious experiences, with the exception of maybe some dreams where it's like, whoa, or one or two exceptions of being under, like, wisdom teeth being taken out and almost like leaving the body and like seeing myself. There have been some aspects like that, but in my meditation practice, I've never really gone to those particular ethereal or subtle places. It's more or less a connection of being within the body and maintaining within the body, but going towards, yeah, maybe the translation we have in English is like transcendence or like achieving something within this body. And even though we're only in it for a few minutes, a couple of years, a couple of decades, however long we're in it, is achieving something great within these mind, body, and senses, as opposed to going somewhere else. Whereas my wife, she's a little bit more ethereal attuned and explores meditation practices where you are, yeah, going to more of an astral plane and whatnot.
Yeah, I think that's more interesting to some extent. I mean, there's so much talk about being embodied and all that. That's why this podcast is called Disembodied, because yeah. I see a benefit to being disembodied as well. I mean,
sure.
You can every night be disembodied and actually learn things away from your body. It doesn't need to be like a thing that's bad. If you need to be living and paying attention to something, of course, you should be embodied at that moment. We don't want to drive down the freeway being disembodied. But, you know, I think both ways are valuable to being. And there was something I was just going to ask you. Oh, yeah. You've worked with gurus, right? You've studied under gurus?
Yeah. Yeah. Various different types of gurus, teachers from various lineages around the world. Absolutely.
So did you feel like you ever communicated with them in dreams or when you were meditating?
Yeah. Now that I have had a lot of experience. Well, I mean, maybe it's dramatic to say a lot, but definitely had substantial multiple experiences like that, that were then validated in real life coming out of those experiences. Yeah. Conversations with specifically one of my primary teachers. It's almost, even my wife has had this experience as well. It's almost like whenever we're not getting something in real life, we've always had this experience. It comes in a dream, and, you know, one may write it off as, oh, that's, you know, the mind putting things together or whatnot. But we've had many, more than one, at least, experience where it's almost like an instruction comes in our dream where he presents himself, and it's always in a very loving and delicate way. And even where both of us will wake up and we're like, hey, this crazy dream. You're just like, no, you did. You're lying. And where kind of a message comes through, and then we'll even open a line of communication like, hey, you know, we had this experience. He's like, yeah, this is how I feel about this matter. I feel very strongly about this. And, you know, I didn't want to overstep by pushing this concept in, but I do agree with your new paradigm. And like, you know, these almost like delicate ways of shifting our minds and opinions and perspectives. And yeah, definitely one teacher that seemingly kindly comes to us in a subtle form regularly. But I've also had other experiences with when I was living in India as a monk, where it was not even just one person, but it was like messages would come through in dreams in that particular type of subjective state, or maybe a better word would be impressionable state, where teachings have come through that seemingly were miraculous, or, you know, when coming back into the body after, it was like, where did that even come from? And then again, later validating it through different means, either in the form of books or in the form of speaking with the individuals themselves, and knowing like, how could I have known that? I wouldn't have read that anywhere. This person hasn't presented it anywhere, or whatever the case might be. And anyway, more I could share about that, but definitely had experiences like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have really not attended Self-Realization Fellowship much, but I, when I meditate, and very often I get messages from Paramahansa Yogananda.
Interesting.
And it makes me laugh, because really it's been years since I've been there. And, you know, the Fullerton one is not far from where I live. And I keep thinking, why do I not get there? But every time I even think about SRF, I'll get a message from Yogananda.
Interesting.
And I think, you know, I should probably go. It's a good group of people. I enjoyed it when I did go. And, you know, why not? I mean, so I feel like he's sort of a guru of mine, even though I've not been as dedicated as I could have been to his organization.
I love that. You know, it's interesting you share that. I had a similar kind of experience where, yeah, there's one particular lineage in practice where it was always like internally call. There's like an internal call, like, go there, go there. And I had some resistance, but there's a, I live in Laguna Beach, not too far from you. And there's a center, there's a temple, not too far, just off of the beach, actually off of PCH. And it's very traditional. It's exactly how temples have been run in India for many thousands of years. And I had a very similar experience where it's like, even though I had some resistance at first, like, I don't know, it's a little, even living in India, sometimes traditional temples could be a little culture shocking. And going there, and some of the best things that have ever happened in my life came from opening my heart and going to there and spending other time with, as you mentioned, you know, real cool spiritual individuals that were.
Is it the Hare Krishna temple?
Yeah, Yeah. They call it the ISKCON temple, National Society, something like that.
I've been thinking about going there for a long time. I think I've been to the one in San Diego, but I've never been to the one in Laguna Beach. And I'm thinking of going there just to, you know, talk to people and see what it's like.
I mean, I personally encourage, I mean, I go there regularly now because it's just like the cool. And it's nice too, because sometimes I go to different temples and different types of spiritual centers. And, you know, sometimes it's possible there'll be like one particular type of individual that's there. And it almost becomes, whether it's a cult or not, I mean, it's a culty feeling where it's like, if I'm not in that clique per se, it's like, yeah, I'm an outsider. Whereas one thing I loved about that center, and actually many of their other centers around the world that I've traveled to and spent time, I've actually been to the one in San Diego, they have a couple, but one in Pacific Beach, which is a gorgeous traditional temple there. I love these all types of people. Like, it's just a really cool melting pot of all people from different types of backgrounds, different types of ethnicities and genders and races and whatever the case might be. And then you have everyone from like super ultra successful people to people who are just like getting their life together. And I mean, just a really cool array of individuals. And they actually talk about cool spiritual stuff. It's not like a social gathering where you're just chit-chatting about this, that, the other, but it's like you actually talk about nature and the mind and the soul and our relationship with divinity and all of these concepts, which I personally have as obviously you as well, taste for those types of discussions as opposed to weather school, huh?
No, it's nice to find a group of people that can converse deeply and authentically about anything, really. The one thing I think I've always worried about with ISKCON is that they were a bit dogmatic and they were really into converting people a long time ago. I don't know if they are now. But that, I guess that reminded me of Christianity in a bad way. But I will share some differences. I think that I follow some people, some Hare Krishnas on Instagram, of all places. And what I notice about them is they seem to have so much joy that they want to share with people. And that's part of the Krishna cult, if you will. I'll call it a cult. It's not really a cult, but maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah, it's Westerners. A culture. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of a group aesthetic. They're into dancing ecstatically and kind of just sharing joy with people and joy in life. And that is something that the Christians just don't have much of. I'm going to say from my own experience with Christianity, there was not a hell of a lot of joy to be had. It was an oppressive kind of experience at times to go to Christian retreats and stuff where they're just like crying about stuff. And I don't know. I have negative associations with a lot of it. But if there's one thing that really attracts me to ISKCON, it's that joy of life and willingness to just kind of accept you as you are.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had similar experiences with, I also went, you know, tried different like Christian churches, Christian retreats, et cetera. And it was always like, I was always met with the same thing. It was like, why you ask so many questions? Stop asking so many questions. I was like, no, like, tell me the nature of divinity. It's like, you don't need to know that. It's like, do you know? Like, it doesn't matter. Just have faith. I'm like, it does matter. So I've also had, I mean, no issue with those who practice the faith, but it's definitely not my philosophy. Whereas, yeah, with the Hare Krishna practice, the reason I was always so inclined, especially traveling around India, they were like, I always had this idea, oh, it's just Eastern practices are like that. But it's like, nope. Definitely not all practices that come out of India are like that. And it really stood out in that way. Yeah. And I liked that the joy is the main thing. And then it's all about accepting you for who you are and then adding divinity. Like, because I used to ask so many questions. And again, I had a lot of resistance to for my own, whatever, my own conditioning of going there. But the main thing that I found super exciting, because I would watch Airplane, where it's like the Hare Krishna's coming up and take a flower, give me some money, you know, and like I watched these things and I was like, oh God, I'm not like these people are going to convert me. But it was, as I actually spent time with them, not only did I not have that experience at all, but when I learned the history of it and they explained, like, you know, when they, this culture, which the practice hasn't changed in thousands of years, like what they do, you know, from India. But when it came to the West, the their primary teacher, his name was A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, when he brought it to the West in 65-ish, right around there. You had a bunch of overzealous hippie folk, which kind of went crazy with it. And so there was like a phase of where it was like kind of like, whoop. But what happens, those people who are a little bit overzealous or dogmatic or fanatical, they kind of trickled away, you know, as those type of folk do. You know, nature takes care of it. And, you know, they go on their own path. And then what happens is when the dust settles, it's the real practitioners, the people who are actually very serious about it. And yeah, I actually remember telling one of the monks, and I was like, hey, you like, why aren't you trying to convince me to like do your thing? And they were like, well, if you have questions, I can answer them. And if it just, this just makes sense. Like spirituality shouldn't be based off of just faith. There should be some feeling, but it has to make logical sense. And as we got into it, you know, I've actually found them to have the highest or like the most attractive sense of divinity, because the approach that they have there, which I'm in, I practice bhakti, and the ISKCON is a, actually one of the biggest bhakti practitioners in the world. That, but there's, you know, millions and millions of practitioners of bhakti, whereas ISKCON, I want to say there's probably only, I don't know, maybe a million followers in the world or whatever the case might be. But that specific style, what they teach is that, okay, there's a nature of divinity, and divinity is personal. And the reason it's personal is because all we want in this world is love. 100% of people will agree there's an inherent desire for love and connection, which means relationships. And they say there's four types of relationships with divinity, to love divinity as a like in a service mentality, like you're up, I'm down, we serve, which is very much you find these Abrahamic practices of Christianity, Judaism, Islam. It's like, I'm small, you're big. But the challenge with that formality is it provides a distance. There's only so much intimacy that can be there. If you're serving, you know, yes, master. Whereas there's also a relationship of loving divinity like your own child. Because when you love divinity like a child, like any mother or father experiences, there's an unconditional love. You get nothing from the baby. You just do. It's unconditional love. So loving and taking care of a divinity like that provides even more intimacy. But then there's two other relationships. One is loving divinity like a close friend, and loving divinity like a partner. And so in the bhakti practice, the focus there is how to cultivate this type of intimate connection and relationship with divinity, as opposed to where there's too much formality, where you can't actually get to know divinity. And there's just okay. This idea like, I just serve. It's like, why? Who? And it's like, yeah, okay, serve, but there should be a logical reason behind it. And their logic is, or the logic of those literatures, at least, that have been taught, is that by serving with that mood of love and intimacy, one can actually get to know divinity, so that one doesn't have to like wait until you die and then you go to a heaven. It's not like that. It's like in this very life, one can experience a divine connection, a divine communion. And it's not like you have to go somewhere, but no, in the presence, divinity can come to you, which is very convenient. So anyway, more I can share about that, but that's an idea of what your very beautiful sharing inspired me.
How did you get specifically attached to bhakti yoga? Yeah. Because there are so many different schools of yoga that I get almost kind of confused with all of them.
Sure. Yeah. So I studied the yoga literatures of Patanjali in depth, which are only about 2000, well, only, LOL, only 2000 years old. you know, as I was studying them, it's interesting because the culmination of those, and from that teaching, is where we got the primary yoga philosophy, or as we know it today, which in the West really just becomes a lot of movement, which again, I'm a fan of. I'm a 500-hour certified yoga teacher. Like, I like that style. It's good and healthy for the body, but it's really just, to call it for what it is, it's gymnastics. It's a type of functional fitness gymnastics, and none of which postures are mentioned in the ancient yoga literatures themselves. But in that practice, Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which is like the centermost focus of the yoga as we know it in the West today, talks about this principle of samadhi siddhir ishvara pranidhana. In Sanskrit, this means samadhi siddhir, the perfection of samadhi, or full meditation. The perfection siddhir of samadhi, of meditation, is ishvara pranidhana. Ishvara means the center of the universe, and prana means our life force. Prana and dana is where we get the word in English donation, like to give, dana. And so it, the perfection of all meditation is Ishvara Pranidhana, or to surrender our souls, our life, and give and connect to Ishvara, or the control of the ultimate aspect of divinity. And so when I saw that, I was like, huh, okay, where's this guy get his knowledge from? And I have a challenging nature, for better or for worse, gets me in trouble all the time. But I just have a very, not necessarily cynical, but a little skeptical. I'm like, yeah, prove it. Probably I lean even more towards blind doubt than I do to blind faith. Both are dangerous, but anyway. And then I found out, you know, these literatures, the concepts are from the Vedas, which are the oldest written literatures we have in the world, at least that we know of today, which are dated about 5,000 years ago. The Rig Veda, Samar Veda, Yajur Veda, and Atharva Veda, which are, again, the oldest written literatures we currently have. There are hieroglyphs that date back prior to that, but we don't know what they mean. There's no translation. Whereas in Sanskrit, we still have the language still alive today after all these thousands of years. So you could actually read through it and understand the hundreds of thousands of verses that are written there. And so in that practice itself, it enunciates different styles of yoga. And literally yoga, we have the same word in English to yoke, which comes from huge in Sanskrit. It's the same word, which means to connect or unite. Bhakti literally means loving devotion. That's what the Sanskrit word means. Loving, it's an active devotion. It's not a theoretical, I love. It's like, I do because I love. If you love someone, you serve them. You do things for them. So that's what bhakti means. There's other, you could say, buckets of ways to yoga, to connect with divinity other than bhakti, love and devotion. And one of those is through karma, through activities. You know, I want to go work. I want to do stuff in this world. I want some stuff for myself, but I'm going to give a little bit. I'm going to give in charity. I'm going to take care of others. I'm going to take care of this, that, the other. You give a portion of your hard-earned work and results. And you also have Jnana Yoga, which is you spend your time studying these literatures. There's still something in it for me. It's still conditional, but like I'm going to understand. And then there's Dhyana Yoga, which is the meditation practice. So there's different yoga practices, but all of them culminate in bhakti because that's true love. True love is unconditional. And to the extent that we can start to cultivate divine love, devotional service, bhakti yoga to divinity, to that extent, we're actually going to be able to love everyone else. Because according to the ancient yoga literatures, they say that the ocean is there, but it's not just one ocean. It's a conglomerate of gazillions of tiny H2O particles. So similarly, we, the souls, the selves, we are all connected in a totality, but we're still individuals connected with that totality, just like many drops of water or the particles of sunlight that are coming down. We are those individual particles. We're never just merged into nothingness. We're always individuals, but we're connected with a whole, which is where we're actually properly in touch with the nature of the soul or the self, is when we're connected with everyone else and divinity. And so the practice of bhakti is, rather than going through these other yoga practices, which there's something personal, it's like, I want it for myself, which means there's ego. Going right to bhakti is the practice, whether you're always successful in the practices, that's a secondary conversation, but the idea, that's the ideal. We go in the direction of unconditional loving service towards divinity, which then allows unconditional loving service for all other living entities, because we actually are happy when we serve. We're not really happy when people serve us. Okay, we appreciate it for a minute, but real happiness comes from just unconditionally loving and serving. And that's why they say the greatest happiness. They actually did, we could send and post this, but there's a PubMed data that was provided maybe 3-4 years ago where it was, they tested all of the happy hormones and neuromodulators in the mind of different types of people. And long story short, they found that who are the arguably the happiest people in the world is like new mamas or mamas with multiple children. Because even though the kid does nothing for you, like you wipe his butt, you feed him, you know, it's like, it's just serve. But they were the happiest. Why? Because it is an inherent principle of humans and all of entities that service is what truly brings happiness. The idea of contributing and improving someone's quality of life through my words, actions, experiences, et cetera. And that's ultimately what bhakti yoga is about. So that's what inclined me in that direction. And then as you alluded to also, I hung out with the bhakti practitioners. I was like, you guys are different. They're just like high for it. And I remember I would be like, yeah, when are you gonna like give up the facade? And it's like a week goes by. And it's like a month goes by. And it's like 5 years go by. And then even myself being the proof of the puddings and the tasting. It's like now having spent, you know, I started when I was 16. I read a book called the Bhagavad Gita. So the last 12 years or so that I've been doing these meditation practices, even in my own life, people come and be like, what's your gig, man? Like, come on, you can't be happy all the time. You can't be so positive. Even when you're sad, you somehow like are okay. Like, what gives? And I actually can't take much credit for myself other than doing the practice, like just doing the thing itself, which clearly is working. And I can sincerely say my life feels so successful. I mean, sure, okay, money helps. Don't get me wrong. Having a healthy body helps. Having a mind that cooperates helps. I mean, having a loving relationship with my wife, family, like these things help, but far beyond all those things, which are going to go at some point. A genuine sense of purpose and satisfaction, happiness in life. And I attest that to the practice of bhakti, because I knew what it was like when I didn't have the practices and what I felt like and how my mind fought me. So that's really my, there was the theoretical conviction, but then actually practicing it and seeing the effect on myself and how it improves, again, not only my life, but sharing it with others. And people are like, whoa, no wonder people have been doing this for thousands and thousands of years consistently.
What did you experience in India? Because I assume that you grew more deeply into the bhakti yoga practice while you were there. So yeah. What realizations did you have along the way? Like, was it practicing with groups of people where you learned the most, or by yourself? Or I'm kind of curious how it worked.
Sure. Yeah. Such great questions. I really appreciate this. So I would say there was like three areas. There were three areas that provided conviction. And I just, for better or for worse, my mind likes system. I like things to be very clear and very drawn out. And I want to really understand it. I don't like gaps. I want everything to just make sense. And I would say there's three buckets that provided me conviction at different parts along the journey. One being the community aspect, which is, yeah, you hang out with enough of the people who are practicing and you could see it. You're like, well, it appears that this stuff works. And then there's just a genuine connection where it's like people who, again, they don't want to just yuck it up. They actually want to go deep and like time spent quality. So there's one bucket is the community, having like-minded association, because there's definitely people in the world of practice bhakti where I'm like, I appreciate you, but I'm going to appreciate you from over here, you know, but actually finding like-minded individuals that practice it. Another is the philosophy and logic behind why you do it. Which for me, again, was always like, I never jived with the idea you just have faith. It's like, no, thanks. I don't want to just have faith. I want to have both. I want to have logic and I want to have faith. And so the actual philosophy itself, which, you know, I wound up finding out not only is it the oldest philosophy, it's the most vast. I mean, it's almost like no question unanswered throughout the many hundreds of thousands of verses within the many literatures that were written that we still have preserved till today. So there's the philosophical aspect. And then the third is, again, just the personal experience, just actually doing the practices and seeing that they work and like saying, wait, my mind isn't in control. Like, I don't have to have this addiction, you know, and like getting over, like just things that seem that seemingly, how could I ever get over this? Like my mind actually cooperating. And my mind becoming me being in control of my mind as opposed to my mind being in control of me. So these are like the three buckets. And while I was in India, they happened at different times. So I would say the first step was that community. It was like, whoa, who are these people? Like the only other group of individuals I ever felt so like impressed by was when I would hang out with friends who were in like ROTC, like going in towards the military. But even there, there was a kind of like vulgarity that I didn't like jive with. But I was like, wow, look at these commit, like these guys and gals like mean serious, like they're in. But then it was like, I don't like what they're talking about. But I like that.
Blowing things up.
Yeah. Or even just like, yeah. Anyway, the conversations, I was like, yeah, I don't want to talk about this. But other than that, I never found people who were so impressive. And it was like, they were disciplined, but happily. It wasn't like, they're like, I got to do this. It was like, wow, I can't wait to wake up at 3:30 in the morning to do hours of meditation and just like spend the rest of my day serving others. And I was like, huh? That's the opposite of what I'm taught in school. I'm trying to get everyone to serve me. What do you mean? Why are you so happy? I'm not. And I struggle with ADHD in my whole life from a young kid. They want to put me on this medicine, that medicine, et cetera. And so like I was seeing in real life people who had overcome things I've been struggling with for so long. And so that gave me conviction. I was like, all right, this is worth the try. Because I was going around to other monasteries. I hung out with, you name them. I was like, I want to hang out with them. Anyone I could find practically. But the bhakti practitioners, they were like consistently serious. And even the ones that were like a little weird, it was like you could see that they weren't actually doing the practice. And even there were weird ones, but they were doing the practice, but it was like, okay, weird. It wasn't like they were doing nefarious activities or whatever the case might be. So that was my first like, okay, I want to try this. These people are happy. I want to try this. And then the philosophy just hit me, you know, and like, An example might be just a basic philosophical and theological understanding. Like, okay, you're a soul in a body forever. You're an eternal, blissful, fully cognizant soul that's temporarily in a material body, but the soul never dies or never perishes. It takes forms of different bodies as it goes according to the mentality that you create. So at the time of your when you leave this body, according to the mindset that you created, you will take a corresponding body in the next life. And so anyway, there's a whole concept of like the nature of self and soul, which reconciled so many concerns I had. And then the nature of karma, which reconciled the problem of evil. Like, oh, God isn't doing anything. We have free will, because an all good and all powerful God, an all loving God or divine source, I mean, whatever vernacular excites, but you know, we're just talking about that, the highest of the high powers, if you will. And all loving would want to provide a world where love can exist, and love cannot be forced. It cannot be like, you must love me. It's not love. So therefore, it would provide free will, and all powerful divine source would also not only want to provide free will, but be able to allow free will, if you will. And so all of us individuals have free will to do whatever we want. And therefore, whatever decisions we make, we now have to learn what to and what not to do in order to go back in the direction towards divinity. So if I do something in this life or for my last life that has a repercussion that I need some mental correcting on, that's going to cause me future suffering, I need to be corrected with that. And so the idea of karma means every single action has a following reaction. I was like, oh, that is okay. It's not like God is evil and God is, it's like, no, okay. We make decisions and then we are repercussions for every decision we make, be it in this life or another life. So anyway, there's all these ideas of like the soul and then the nature of divinity, where it's not like someone up there. It's like, no, there's a whole enunciation of various levels of like access to divinity. And, you know, from the personal form to like Lord, the divinity within the heart to divinity. It's like a whole step ladder of consciousness. What to speak of this material world? And like this world is a place for, you could say, correction, where if we have free will, we get to come, which we do, we get to come here and experience what things are like to be the center of the universe. Until we realize this isn't actually satisfying. And therefore, we turn back towards divinity and being connected with divinity and everyone else. And so the philosophy just, I was like, whoa, every question I had, someone had an answer. Whereas I had so many experiences, every other like place of worship I went, it was like question, question, question. Like, you ask too many questions, just have faith.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned karma, because, and that every decision you make has a repercussion, because I think what people may not realize is that sometimes doing nothing is a bad choice for karma. Because, I mean, think about if you witness crimes, witness terrible things, and then, but never like say anything about it, never do anything about it, that also has a karmic implication, I would think.
Absolutely.
That's where it's kind of sad, really. Like there are people that I think spend a lot of their time escaping in this day and age, escaping reality with movies and video games and smoking weed. And, you know, I'm sounding like a total prim and proper goody two shoes type. I'm not so much that, but I do notice it a lot. Like everybody seems to be escaping things. It's kind of common. You know, sometimes I start to think, okay, should I really watch a movie or should I do something more productive? I'm having that realization myself. Like, don't just sit around watching movies on the weekend, you know, do something else, do something more. You have to make the most out of this life. I think you have to utilize it as a great learning experience. And also, you know, to see where you can be helpful. I don't believe that everybody can be Mother Teresa and take in the poor and the sick. I just don't believe everybody's capable of that. But think about the little things you can do to make some sort of reverberation that would be positive. And I think people should think about that a little bit during the course of their life and not just when they're old and ready to die. Better to think about it throughout your life and utilize whatever chances you have to express goodwill towards others. Sometimes just being kind to people in general can help. But I think the thing that perplexes me about karma, though, is like, I've thought about this lately, like, how can you evolve maybe to become a human, to have several lives as a human, and then you just throw it all away by doing terrible things? Say you decide randomly to kill people, you know? I mean, I think about these serial killers and just different people that they don't just create one terrible event. They keep creating terrible events and exacting a toll on humanity. And I'm thinking, how do you evolve to the point of being a human who's had some incarnations and then you just throw it all away? That's weird to me.
Weird. I totally agree. And sad. It's like, you know, because the human form of life is so rare. I don't know if we're not taught from a young age to like consider how rare the human form is. If you look at all other living entities in the world, from the giraffes to the spiders to the plants, all other living entities and conscious entities, we are a very tiny, 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 tiny fraction in that pot of how many humans there are in relation to all of the conscious entities out there. And even to become a human, like for the sake of being graphic, it's like at the time of conception, it's not like one, there's many souls that have the opportunity to take form, but what are the chances that one sperm actually enters into one egg, which actually goes through the full pregnancy to actually be born, to actually live a life? It's astronomical chances to be a human. It's just crazy that we have the fortune to be in a human body, because we have what makes us so special to be human, and not special that we're better, but just unique, is that we have a prefrontal cortex. We can ask questions. We can conceive of things that other entities cannot. I mean, I love animals, big fan. I like to take care of cows myself. We got a farm in Escondido that we like to take care of cows. Like, big fan animals. But the big difference is they do not have the ability to ask questions about the nature of the soul and the nature of the universe, the nature of divinity, because from that question it can provide transcendence, where as opposed to just being stuck in instinctual action and just by reactionary programming. And so the human form of life not only is so rare, it's crazy we even have this opportunity, but because we're born as a human, it gives us the ability to ask good questions to provide us, as you're mentioning, improving the quality of lives of others. It doesn't take a lot, you know, just like you mentioned, one bad action causes a lot of bad reactions. One good action could cause a lot of good reactions. And who even cares about what the reactions are? The secondary reactions are, we just want to do what we can. And in Sanskrit, there's this term called dharma, which means the intrinsic quality of something. And they say that every living entity, every single one of us, has an intrinsic, unique gift that has been cultivated, that has been given, you know, from a young age, or certain things that we didn't have to learn. We just kind of knew. We kind of like learned a little bit, but we just had a knack for it. And they say that if we can get in touch with your dharma and figure out, what can I do to improve the quality of lives of others? Doesn't have to be everyone. Could be five people. Could be one person. Could be 300. Doesn't matter. It's just, what can I do to take my unique psychophysical nature and conditioning and gifts and use that to somehow inspire, somehow improve the quality of life of other individuals? Then that's where real happiness can be achieved in this very life, when one follows that dharma. And as you were so eloquently expressing, that all it takes is one good, like one gesture of kindness, one little thing of improving, you know, someone's day, week, year, life, and to make a serious impact in that person's life. And then they'll make an impact in someone else. And it's exponential in that way.
Right. Now, there's no motivation to live in the world, really, if there's no kindness. It's pretty depressing if you start dwelling on all the things going wrong. There's really not a strong motivation to just keep going. You have to have that. You have to find that goodwill somehow in people and others around you. Otherwise, you just think, I don't want to be here, you know?
Oh, I mean, I've definitely had my nihilistic thoughts where it's just like, what's the use? Actually, that was also a big thing that the bhakti tradition like helped me understand. Was like, oh, okay, yeah, this place is meant to be a little miserable, so we realize we're not actually happy being detached from source. Like when we're actually detach ourselves from source, that's where the discomfort and dissatisfaction comes. And so, like any proper correctional facility, like this material world is, if everything was just sunshine and rainbows and just dandy, then we'd have no impetus to want to get out of this place, get out of the jail cell. And so similarly, this world has to have a little bit of like, yeah, this isn't my home forever. There has to have a little bit of that feeling, and then reconciled, oh yeah, that's why, like, there's something greater than this. And it's not only looking at the bright side, but oh yeah, there's something magnificent that we could do in this life.
Yeah, absolutely. The world is beautiful and ugly simultaneously.
Yeah.
You know, duality. It's a realization that we make every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the duality, it's just how it works. That's how the material world is. There's this side and there's that side. Yeah.
Well, what I notice is that you have retreats coming up, one in Greece, one in India. So maybe we should talk a little bit about that. One is a yoga retreat, I believe, the one in Greece.
Yeah. And that's in a couple of weeks. So that one is, we are capped out there, but join us next year. Yeah, that's a yoga retreat that we'll be doing. And the other one is also a yoga retreat, but we call it a pilgrimage through India. Having lived there for so long, what I do is I take individuals around the sacred places of India and give them a great experience. Like, we go to an eco village, completely self-sustaining eco farm. We go to up to Rishikesh, which is the yoga capital of the world, and stay right on the beautiful river Ganges, pure pristine river, and you go to various sacred places there. And that, I will say too, we're pretty much at capacity as well. So as much as I want you and all our listeners to join us, you're going to have to join us for 2025, and we'll be happy to take you then.
Yeah, I would consider it. Absolutely. You know, that's coming up pretty quickly, January even, but yeah, maybe in 2025, I will go. I haven't been to India yet. I would love to go, and I would love to go with a group, you know, and with somebody who's experienced, because I can't imagine that I would ever go by myself. So.
Well, I'll say this, because now it'll be forever recorded on the internet, but I'd love to bring you, and we'll find a way to bring you as a guest
when the time comes.
Love to have you join us. And yeah, it's great. You know, having a group is just, it's a game changer. And we've got, 43 people as of right now coming with us in January. It's a big group. And so you feel fortified. It's just like nothing wrong could happen. You got like a mob of other, almost everyone's, everyone this trip is from North America specifically. And so it's like-minded people in a similar stage of life, also having a spiritual experience there, not just to like sightsee, but actually like, let's go deep. Let's sit with the nature of the self.
That's a perfect exploration of India, really, because I don't want to go just to take pictures. I would really want to experience some of the sights hands-on and really see more than just cities, but just like experience places and energies. You know, that attracts me more.
Totally. Well, don't threaten me with a good time. I'll be very happy. Very happy to get you coming to India with us. Yeah, that'll be great.
You also do consultations anyway on a daily basis, right? You're helping people improve their mindset. You're doing some coaching, so people can also utilize those services that you offer, right?
Yeah, there's two primary ways that I get deep, that gets me up in the morning, excited to start my day and help. And there's two areas that, one area where I spent many years as a monastery cultivating, and one is around that. I call it overall health, where it's physical, mental, and spiritual health, in the form of not only upgrading our mindset and moving through limiting beliefs and the traumas that are just keeping us stuck in the same habits, but also principles of what's called Ayurveda. It's ancient Eastern health science, which gets the physical body operating from a completely holistic perspective. And, in terms of optimizing sleep, diet, every aspect of your health naturally without having to depend on artificial things. And then, spiritual practices in terms of clear meditation. So everyone I work with, we do two things. One is this whole holistic renovation. But over the last 5 years, what I've actually done is I went in the direction of just teaching holistic health, which I did for the first about 3 years. But these last two now, what happened was, after starting my holistic business online, I'm very grateful to say that we're able to help a lot of people. And within the first year, we had a multi six-figure business. And then the second, it doubled, and it just kept growing. And what happened was, all these other holistic professionals that I would talk with, they were like, help, how do you do this? Like, I want to help more people. I want to make somebody doing it. And so what happened these last 2 years, I've actually taken my focus and helping people develop sustainable business models as well, so that they can do what they want, make enough money to support themselves. I mean, I'm not interested in teaching people how to become fabulously wealthy and how to get as much money as possible. No, it's like, but how do you make plenty of money so that you have everything covered, you give in charity to all the places that you want, that you got your long-term save? Like, how do you establish that? And primarily I almost exclusively now work with like wellness professionals, health coaches, and show them how to create sustainable online businesses as well. And that's really been a passion of mine, again, for more than 2 years, but 2 years now focusing and helping them, because the meditation before was helping people directly. But the people I was helping, they weren't necessarily going to go and change a bunch of others' lives. Now, I'm so I feel so grateful that I get to help people who directly are going to change many other people's lives. So let's say, you know, the 20 clients I'm working with now, each of them, if they're helping out at least 20, then, you know, we can exponentially grow. So my vision is, how do we get all of these holistic health professionals together back to back so that we can really make an impact in this world? So everyone knows I can heal too. I don't have to depend on all these artificial methodologies. I can actually heal. I have everything that I need from my skin within to achieve the life that I want. And obviously utilizing some things outside to expedite that, but everything I need from the skin inward. So those are the two primary things I focus: holistic health, mindset, meditation practices, as well as all the system strategies, campaigns, marketing, sales, et cetera, of growing an online business.
Wow, that's a lot, actually. That's that must show that you've studied well along the way, and you've not only grown spiritually, but you know, you have some business sense, and you know a little bit about worldly things in a good way. In this respect, it's to help others ultimately. So I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, cool thing being a monk is you learn how to learn things quick. One of the main things you learn there is how to comprehend knowledge in a way that it sticks. And so, yeah, even though I'm definitely, you know, it's 5 years that I've been studying the business side of things, but I definitely love that. And it's, you know, it's just fun for me to, again, like put things together and like put the math together. How many people can you help? How does your day have to look? And putting that together. And it's fun to see someone else feel empowered. Like they don't have to do this as a side hustle, like, and have to work a job where they don't even want to do it. And then on the side, they help others. Now it's like, how do you make enough money, work the hours you want, actually changing lives? And it would be really lame and out of integrity for me to not share that with others, because it's a gift. I'm so grateful that I had that opportunity. It was seemingly a miracle that it all came together. So now that I can do that with others, how couldn't I share that? It wouldn't be fair. So that's how I feel. And I'm certainly very grateful.
Well, I certainly appreciate you. I'm so glad that you came on, and I would love to have you back again down the line, and we can talk about more stuff, because I think we kind of probably have only started the conversation in a way. But anyway, Madhu, thanks so much. And we'll put the link to your website in the show notes for this episode so people can catch up with you if they want to.
Yeah. And we've got a free community, which is just to give as much of this information away as possible. It's called the Monk Mindset. So if anyone has any interest in that, you just find me on any platform, madhu.life, madhu.life. Any platform you find me there, send me a message, and then we'll give you access to our free group for developing the Monk Mindset. And I just wanted to thank you, Evie, because I don't know if everyone listening knows, but it's a burden of love. It takes a lot of time and energy to go into putting these types of podcasts out. And I'm so grateful that you are, because you're giving this knowledge out freely so that all of us can just come together and actually learn and actually achieve great things in our life with what you're teaching. So much appreciation to you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
Blessed listener, please leave your questions or comments for this episode or any other episode at disembodiedpodcast.com. Thanks so much.